Kata opening the sutra.
Series that began with the one that talked about Brian S. Wilson, the Ordinary Mind talk. And I think they may, I'm going to do one more and then I'll leave you alone about this for a little while. So this talk begins with the precept. I vowed to take up the way of not being greedy. As the fears stored in our collective unconscious emerge and manifest in our pop culture, it is zombies and vampires that are threatening the United States. However, in reality, it is hungry ghosts that are overrunning our country. The hungry ghost is an archetype in Buddhist psychology. It is depicted as a being whose tiny throat does not allow it to ever consume enough to fill its belly. So it is on a never-ending, futile quest to save itself. In a very direct sense, this describes the life of a person living with an addiction who consumes more and more of the object of their compulsion but cannot achieve satisfaction for more than a few moments, if at all. In this country, we are all addicted. Some of us are addicted to alcohol and drugs. For some, it's a process addiction such as sex or gambling. But the vast majority of us are addicted to consumption, to excessive and usually unnecessary buying, as we plunge headlong towards the depletion of our planet's resources and catastrophic climate change. There are a number of related addictions, which are also prevalent and which contribute to this cycle of destruction. These include addictions to power, to status, and to wealth. As a culture, we are consumed by all of these forms of insatiable greed. Just like the person living with a severe substance use addiction, those of us who are caught in the cycle of consumption and the related obsessions use rationalization and denial to avoid any clear examination of the state our lives are in. Our eyes remain closed to the potentially disastrous consequences of our continued obsession, and our reactions can turn violent when the supply of the thing we crave is disrupted, such as when we fear that our supply of oil may be disrupted. We may complain from time to time about the pharmaceutical companies, the big oil companies, the big banks, and the other large corporations, as well as the chain restaurants and big box stores that clutter our exurban landscapes. But we will never act decisively against their interests because, like any addict, we won't willingly help to cut off our supply of the drug. We may hate them, but we want the things they make and sell to remain readily available to us. Of course, these institutions also work hard to actively support and sustain our compulsions. They do so through their control of our government officials, who not only protect their interests directly, they also help us avoid any trace of guilt by reminding us that spending is patriotic and necessary for the economy. They also do so through the endless advertising that bombards us around the clock, reaching our brains through the assortment of electronic media that hold us in their hypnotic gaze. When we have moments where we see our behavior clearly, it's easy to become a victim of despair. What good will it do for me to change, to break out of the cycle of greed? Everyone's doing it, The corporations are powerful, and the government is right in it with them. My changing won't help in any appreciable way. Every day in this country, hundreds of thousands, perhaps even millions of Americans go through this calculus and are deterred from action because of this despair in the face of the belief that everyone is doing it. The fact that government is strangulated by its own gridlock processes, as well as being in bed with the large moneyed interests, is true. As is the fact that those interests, and not the will of the American people, are the prevalent force in our land. However, the survival of our earth relies on our willingness to avoid becoming personally paralyzed and impotent because of this. Recently, I read a piece written by a Norwegian philosopher, Arne Næss, the father of the deep ecology perspective, which he wrote in the early 1970s. In it, he argues that the environmental movement of that time made a fundamental error. They chose to blame and chastise those who were careless and neglectful of the environment. Instead, Næss argues, people should be encouraged to include the world and all beings in the biosphere in a broadened definition of self. Just as we naturally take care of our own bodies, when we see the world as ourselves, caring for it will be a simple, natural act. The same concept was later expanded upon by Joanna Macy in her book, World as Lover, World as Self. This is the very thing that our Zen practice points to as we awaken to the reality of the one body. This entire world, this entire cosmos is our body. As we deepen our realization of that, we can see what others are doing doesn't matter. We have no choice but to take action. Our body is under attack. What will we do about it? At Treetop, we have a new affirmative precept that is the companion to the precept of I vow to take up the way of not being greedy. It is, I vow to take up the way of living simply. Just as with all of the precepts, each of us is going to start at a different place with this pair of intentions. And just as with all of the precepts, we won't keep them perfectly. Realizing these two realities is crucial. We must avoid perfectionism, which is another doorway into despair, as addicts know. I can't be perfect, so I might as well not try, is a phrase that many of us have uttered to rationalize a relapse or some personal failing. Following the spirit of the precepts, we must focus on our own adherence. What others are or aren't doing is irrelevant. It is all about our personal responsibility. In the 12-step programs, people are encouraged to avoid taking others' inventory, keeping the focus on their own program and their own recovery. That notion of personal responsibility is similar to that of the precepts. In that spirit of taking our own inventory, we must engage in a really penetrating evaluation of our own life. We must look at how we are taking care of our one body, just as we do in the Fusatsu ceremony when we renew our intention to keep the precepts. How much unnecessary expending do I engage in? How much of my waste and resource depletion could be prevented through retaining, reusing, and restoring things I already have, rather than buying something new? How much fossil fuel do I burn on unnecessary trips? How often do I walk, bicycle, or use public transportation instead of cars? How conscious am I of buying locally grown organic foods? What example am I setting for my children, neighbors, and colleagues? Am I part of the everybody that is living blindly, unconscious of my impacts? Or can that I say I am truly living simple, taking care of our body? When they wake up to the truth of their lives, addicts realize that they must change or die. If we waken to our addictions, our relationship to the world, then we must realize that we will change or place not just our lives, but those of everybody being on the planet in jeopardy. We cannot simply blame others and throw up our hands in despair. We must act each and every day. Living simply is a beautiful intention that has many impacts and many benefits beyond minimizing our negative environmental impacts. As the original proponent of voluntary simplicity, Henry David Thoreau observed, "The price of excessive complexity, of over-immersion in ownership and commerce, is the loss of our time, the very essence of our lives." Freeing himself through a simple life at Walden Pond, Thoreau was able to become an intimate partner in the rhythm of life that surrounded him, which his otherwise preoccupied neighbors were scarcely aware of. Living simply, we can engage more fully with our partners, family, and friends. We can spend real time with our children, not just snatches of quality time that are grabbed amidst a flurry of frenetic activity. We can deepen our spiritual practice. We can enjoy a leisurely meal. We can take time to watch the true miracles, a butterfly dancing in a sunny meadow, a hummingbird poised at the feeder, a deer with her fawns grazing at the edge of the woods. An incredible opportunity awaits us if we can free ourselves from greed. Please avoid the fear and doubt by following this simple way of daily effort of manifesting loving kindness on behalf of Mother Earth. Our lives can and will make a difference. So the other thing I wanted to add this morning, if somebody sent me a link this week to a show that Bill Moyers did recently on Deep State. Did any of you see that show? You want to. Well, you don't want to because it's not very good news, but it's a PBS show that he did, and after we see if anybody wants the link, I can give it to you. And it's an interview with a guy who was a Republican congressional staffer, I think for the Congressional Budget Committee, and who has since left the Republican Party and written a book about deep state. And what he says deep state is an alliance between the military-industrial complex, Wall Street, and Silicon Valley. And that they are running the country. And it doesn't matter whether Republicans or Democrats, that's all, that Congress is just sort of playing with themselves there. And regardless, you know, what administration is in and so on and so forth, this deep state, this, you know, huge thing that's lurking out there, that's grown even larger since 9/11, when all of these various intelligence and security things, you know, mushroomed. And it, he said when he, the thing that made him realize it, when he sort of woke up to it, was initially we were funding, you know, through his working budgets, money's going to Afghanistan. And he said, well, he understood that because the Taliban were supporting Al-Qaeda and there was sort of a direct relationship, or at least we saw it at that time. And then he said all of a sudden these millions and millions of dollars started going to the Persian Gulf. And you know, he kind of woke up, was like, why are we there? Why are we spending, you know, money there? Why are we sending troops there? It has sort of no bearing on our security, no bearing. And that was where he sort of woke up to the idea that we're having perpetual wars because of these people. They benefit from these wars. They want these wars. And so it has nothing to do anymore with the interests of the country or the American people, and just this kind of behemoth that's behind. And therefore, doesn't matter what George W. Bush or Barack Obama, yeah, we get a different shade, but we don't get really substantially different priority. You know, Many of us thought Obama would take leadership on these environmental issues, for example. He's done buckus. You know, so when you see it, when you see the show, I mean, for me it was like, okay, these are things I've suspected, or these are things that, you know, but this guy just ties it all together. Silicon Valley is sort of in it because they have benefited tremendously from the whole sort of security industry aspect. So that they became a part of it because they're major players in the development of all the stuff that the NSA is using in all of these various bodies of anyway. So I you know, I mentioned that in the context of this because I keep going back to, you know, part of what frustrates us is that government isn't doing anything. And part of the conclusion I've come to, and I probably said it before, so again, I don't believe government is going to do it. You know, we've got to do it. The government is not, short of some cataclysmic thing, government is no longer responsive either to our needs or to the needs of the earth. You know, it's marching to a completely different drummer, the drummer of greed, amazing greed. You can't even imagine, you know, this sort of unimaginable scale. You know, he was talking about how, he said Petraeus was sort of the poster child for this relationship. So Petraeus comes out of the military and immediately is hired by, you know, a major Wall Street firm, you know, the kind of, you know, and that's where the generals go. The generals aren't going, I don't know what, they're going into big corporate places, you know, because it keeps cement. It's like, you know, the old thing where the king would give his daughter to to the neighboring duke or something, so to keep cement the alliance. You know, these kinds of things are, you know, going on. And so, anyway, slight digression, but. Thing. I showed it to my students this week, and they were like, not surprised. You know, they were just didn't surprise them at all.
Also, you could replace every CEO and all of these corporations, and nothing would change.
Oh yeah, absolutely not.
It's a structural thing. It's not like a conspiracy run by a single mind. It's just the way things go.
Well, in fact, I think you talked about there are laws that the management has to try to make a profit for the board, for the stockholders. Yeah. And so if they fail to do that, they can be liable, they can, you know, they could be prosecuted and so on. So it's sort of this machine now is just running with its own.
One of the things that seems to be happening also is that the dream has been is we're trying to arrive at some sort of security. I mean, there are an awful lot of people who start businesses with the idea that they're going to eventually get bought out, and then whatever this organization they put together is no longer their baby, and they've got the retirement home and the, you know, and the fat check at the end of it. And one of the things I think it's related to this is that there was an article in the Portland paper about how all the consolidation in the health hospitals hasn't lowered costs at all. It hasn't. The quality of care hasn't improved. I mean, it has shown nothing but the fact that essentially costs have gone up, and the whole thing has become more corporatized. And basically, the bureaucracy is determining the therapy of the doctor. And so, you know, what's feeding that? You know, my doctor's practice has just been bought out by Maine General. I understand how much work a physician does. You know, I can totally understand the appeal of just sort of signing on the dotted line, and you no longer have the responsibility for maintaining that practice.
It's increasingly impossible to maintain a private practice. One of my close friends is an internist, and he has a very bare bone practice, or had one, and it wasn't until the 16th of the month that he made it a nickel. So he goes to work for Maine General, and he's making 200 grand. He was making less than his brother, who was a high school principal, and after 25 years in practice.
Yeah.
So
there you go.
And then they have to pay for that hospital there, which is already doesn't have enough beds. It's like a week later.
There's a good book on a lot of these structural issues. It's by he's a Zen teacher in the the Aitken lineage, David R. Loy. It's called Money, Sex, War, Karma. And he talks about how it's not enough to kind of have your own personal awakening, that we've got to sort of work for a societal awakening. And he coined this term, wego, that it's like sort of the collective ego of our nation, of our world. Uh-huh. It's interesting.
Yeah, David Loy, Ellen Tynan connected with him out in Colorado last summer, and they really liked him.
I've got the book if anybody wants to borrow it. It's a good book.
I had a thought. I'm not sure if it's profound or not. Money has been called the root of all evil, but I think that's not strictly accurate. I think money is the sap of evil, and the evil is when a plant grows so large that it's actually damaging what's around it, and its only impulse is to grow bigger. And the plant that's gotten huge like that is kind of the metaphor for our corporations and institutions that are governing our country's behavior. And one of the things that I've observed as a solo medical practitioner is that behavior follows money to an incredible degree. Sometimes it's conscious, sometimes it's not, but that's the way things tend to go. And I think what Peter's presenting is that we have an opportunity to let behavior follow value and to work for those things that we value rather than those things that are going to pay as the first priority.
I think that's true. You know, working in a for-profit industry as I do, you know, I work for a company and it happens to be editorial, but, you know, it's not enough anymore to just make a profit and be able to pay everybody in your organization and put the rest in your bank account. You have to grow every year by a certain, you know, and at some point that becomes unsustainable. You know, you can't sort of grow indefinitely. And if that happened, like your metaphor, Alan, if that happened in a biological context, we call that cancer. But in a business context, we don't see any problem with it.
Yeah, this is something that I've thought a lot about, and it's sort of clear to me, you know, that the problem is not capitalism or the free market. The problem is the greed. The problem, you know, if you know, and this, I'm going to write a talk around this sometime. You know, I started sort of the example of a guy who's an organic farmer and he's growing rutabagas, you know, and he's bringing those rutabagas to the farmer's market and he charges whatever it is, 70 cents a pound, and people are happy to pay it because they're getting these nice organic rutabagas, you know, and as far as I, you know, can see, there's nothing wrong with that. But at some point he sees a Cadillac Escalade go by and he says, I want one of those. And his wife says, well, you can't afford one of those, dear. And so now he's got to change his whole strategy. His little rutabaga farm. So he's got to start. So he drops his prices. Oh, looks good. He forces all his competitors out. He picks up their land cheaply. You know, he annexes their farms. Now he's not going to grow organically because he's got an agribiz. He's just going to, you know, and he realizes he can get the same amount of money, but he's going to, you know, and so on and so forth. And so all of a sudden, we have a totally different thing from this very fair exchange between a very conscientious human being to this, you know, behemoth thing, so that he can have his Escalade or what, you know, what, you know. But that, that's what's happening in the country. That's what you just both described on a much grander scale. I mean, I think that's the idea. It's not, you know, that people shouldn't be able to make a living or a fair, you know, it's that they're not content with a fair exchange, and you know, it's got to be this constantly expanding and a huge wealth. It's not enough to make $100,000 a year or $200,000 a year. These guys are getting, what, $100 million a year, $200 million a year? You know, crazy, 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 crazy numbers, you know?
I've got two little things. They're very different. For some reason, I started getting this magazine called Inc. Magazine, which is for, like, small entrepreneurs. And there was this thing on, and it was like, how to not grow a business. And it was all on the sector of medium-sized sort of tech businesses in Germany. And the model over there is no. When something comes in the door and somebody wants something that basically doesn't quite fit what you do, you turn them down. There's another guy down the road who does that. We do this very well, and it's working really well, and that's what we do. And this business owner compared that to the American model, where, well, of course we would do it. How can we change it? How can we do it? And this situation boom and bust, with a lot of people getting knocked around in the process of this sort of greedy cowboy economy that the American economy focuses on. And, you know, somehow the idea of the Germans being our paradigm for, you know, maybe how something might run is sort of odd. But, you know, and then the other little glimpse was watching the Olympics, and actually this is on the Daily Show, and a commentator asked the Dutch speed skating coach, well, what do you think happened with the Americans this year? They didn't match expectations or anything like this. And the guy went off on this whole rant on this sense of entitlement that Americans have, yeah, about what they need to do, about how they have to be in the world, and why wouldn't they be dominating in the world, yeah, in the world of speed skating? And it's just, it was this magnificent, what is it with you people? What is it? Americanism. It was beautiful. Some of that is related to that sort of a cowboy economy that this whole American, compared to, frankly, you know, the Germans have had a functional, privately based healthcare system that was established by the Kaiser in 1905. You know, there's an enlightened culture. You know,
well, they had a glitch along the way.
Well, I know they kind of went off the rails once in a while. But I mean, it's.
Yeah, they also had banking laws that prevented the greed thing. They didn't go through the whole greed deal.
Yeah.
That you have to pay a lot down to buy a house in Germany, and all the little banks, the community banks, had. There were rules about how much you had to put down, and they didn't budge at all. So they didn't have any foreclosures. They didn't have any of the crap that we had. Whereas next door, you know, in England, they were greedier than we were.
Yeah.
Well, you know, the people know the story of Ben and Jerry's. So they started out making ice cream in this converted gas station in Burlington. I used to go there and. They made this wonderful ice cream. You know, they still had like, they weren't hand churns, but they were just churns sitting there, and they it was all local fresh ingredients, Vermont Mill, and blah blah blah. All right, so of course we know that they started to become more and more and more successful, but they were also very conscientious, very green, very, treated their employees, you know, extremely well. You know, all of these things. They were very socially and conscious and environmentally conscious and so on. Well, it comes to some point, they decide they're going to go through a major expansion. So they've got to go to the banks, and they're going to borrow whatever it is, $5 million or $10 million or whatever, you know, some big sum of money. And the banks say, fine, but Ben and Jerry, you can't run the company anymore. And they just sidelined them. And they brought in corporate managers, and they retained Ben and Jerry as figureheads. You know, you can go out and do ribbon cuttings and, you know, and all that, but you can't actually make any corporate decisions. And because we're gonna, and these professional guys are gonna do it, you know. So that it, and it's still a good company, but then of course they sold out eventually to what, General Foods or something. Somebody owns them now, and now it's just complete sham. But so that's the process, you know. You had a couple of guys with integrity, doing it with integrity, and yeah, they were making some money, but they had an outstanding product, and then it just snowballed into something.
Was there something about a employee? Were they partially employer-employee owned?
They may have been initially. I thought I heard
that the employees also had voted to go that route. That okay, well, what we've been is nice, but there's more money here if we go that route.
Yeah, well, it may well be. I mean, it may well be. It's not only the fat cats who are greedy; we're all subject to.
I just heard this morning on Bob Edwards' program about a New Yorker writer writing about Amazon and how Amazon has just taken over. Mm-hmm. That, I mean, they don't even like books. They tried publishing at one point and they were no good at it. They didn't know what they were doing. So, but publishers have to pay Amazon for Amazon to sell their stuff. And Amazon keeps expanding and expanding and doing anything and everything for the customer to make it faster, cheaper. But in so doing, they are just subsuming all the book publishers and the small guys. I mean, if the small guy says, no, I'm not going to cooperate, then, you can't make use of Amazon. But everybody uses Amazon. And so we all do. I'm sure we all do. But maybe at some point we have to decide not to. We don't need that book in 2 days. We can go to Barnes & Noble.
Having worked there, and they're a nice little company, but they're not much better.
Well, okay, yeah. But I mean, there's.
I just wish they were Amazon.
Yeah. Well, they're not gobbling up the publishing industry.
But I mean, books are really important to all of us, and so maybe at some point we need to make some decisions about how we acquire books, how we relate to the books that we rely on.
Yeah. So librarians have grown to hate books. The librarian at Colby took half the books out of the collection and secretly threw away books, thousands of them, just put them in the trash.
What?
To open up space so that it would be more like a restaurant or something like that. They invested in big leather couches for everybody.
Oh, like Starbucks, bring in the coffee and...
Yeah, and they didn't tell anybody about it either. I just spent last week in a fury. I was talking to Peter about it, and Dustin, just in a fury about sort of one little section of that. A student protested, and then they just worked to intimidate him, and finally quit. But they're also following what people are doing. And students are not spending time in libraries, partly because the faculty are not assigning books. But the whole idea, big part of my growth as a student was going into the stacks and looking for a book, and then seeing the other 20 books on either side of it, and then spending the day would be gone, and I'd be in there, and I discovered a giant number of connections I never even knew existed. So that's just been cut in half, and this is what they've done this at all these other colleges and universities everywhere else. So it's not like, and he would say that he loves books, but there's too many of them, which may be.
That's certainly what they said in Germany in 1936.
they didn't have quite a bonfire. They just stuck them out in trucks. We don't even know how many they threw away. But.
It's crazy. I'm thinking what you said, Deborah. If I hadn't heard, if you hadn't just told me that, I wouldn't be aware of what, I just send my, like everybody else, I go online and I pick out a book and I'm just about to buy a book. And I was thinking, I'll get it from Amazon. It's so easy, and it shows up here 2 days later, and all that stuff. That's a part of it too. Is just our awareness. Part of it is just not knowing. I think, and probably the people in this room are sort of on the average much more aware than many other people, and yet, I for one didn't know that. Before.
And they're not showing a great profit now because they're putting all the money back into these warehouses that they're positioning in places so that even before you order a book, they're anticipating that you're going to order that book.
Oh,
so
yeah.
They have this warehouse all ready to go.
They have an algorithm just like you.
Yeah. They
So you probably think of the cops. There's a little company started up called Geodata, which tracked tweets. And so it turned out that tracking tweets was one of the best damn things that you could ever do to predict what a consumer would do. And so they sold that to Hukiwaga, I don't know what it was, Google or somebody. and you can buy that data if you're a police force, so you can find out. The head of the Georgia police said, it's like having free or almost free stakeout. You can find out what Clem Cadiddlehopper is doing, you know, following the breadcrumb trail. And you can pounce on him at any point. And his point was, it's not against the law, but it's not right. But there's no restraint on that.
Well, look at this new information storage site that the NSA just created out in Utah, which they said has a capacity to hold as much information as every book that's been written in the history of written language.
Yeah. I think that's one flash drive.
Yeah.
What's that?
I think that's one flash drive. You can put in your pocket.
Well, it is one building. It's massive, but it's you know.
No, I mean, well, the other one, we can get lost in all this stuff.
One other point I want to make about that was that they have gone, Amazon has gone out of its way to take people out of the equation. People are just invisible. You click on things and you get things. You may say hello to the UPS driver, but they just take the human element completely out of it. But if you go to a warehouse, then there are a bunch of pretty unhappy people, you know, shuffling things around, which may in time be taken over by robots. So,
well, right, robots
this dehumanizing
snort oxycodone on their break, or you know.
The zombies, back to the zombies.
Back to the zombies. Well, that is, I think that is a living archetype, you know. And, we have many of them walking around our towns and cities now.
Philip K. Dick, right? Do androids dream of electric sheep?
Well, this is depressing.
Yeah. So on that note, I'm going to find the guy.
Well, and again, the core of my message is we can't let it depress us.
Yeah.
You know, and we're going to have that for a moment, but we need praxis. We need to translate that into changing the things we can.
Mm-hmm.
Starting with ourselves.
I'd like to.
And how do you navigate that path of being awake and aware and paranoid? Mm-hmm. Becoming paranoid.
I'd like to remind people that the purpose of most news is not to inform, but to...
Most what?
The purpose of most news is not to inform, but to alarm, because that's what sells.
Mm-hmm.
So if corporations are addicted to money, we're addicted to fear.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's important to guard yourself from too much information, which makes you feel depressed. It is important to align yourself with people, with organizations that are moving in a direction that you can support, because that is what will encourage you.
Absolutely. I'm networking all over New England now with people who are doing, you know, eco communities and things, you know, because exactly that, it can feed me, and I can feed, you know, we can feed each other and stay positive, you know. And there's a lot happening. You just don't know it. You know, if we sit here, it's like, oh, there's nothing happening. But there's lots of stuff happening, you know, so it's a matter of tying those pieces together and for ourselves and being able to feel positive about it. I think that's very important.
Creations are numberless. I vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to put an end to them. Reality is boundless. I vow to perceive it, the enlightened way is unsurpassable. I vow to embody it, creations are numberless. I vow to free them, delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to put an end to them, reality is boundless. I vow to perceive it, the enlightened way is unsurpassable. I vow to embody it, creations are numberless. I vow to free them, delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to put an end to them, reality is boundless. I vow to perceive it, the enlightened way is unsurpassable.